Welcome back to Pony Finance 101. Today we are going to be talking about investing. Investing can be a huge thing to take on, especially in college. I actually looked it up, and according to PRNewsWire.com, only 14% of students invest. However, it can be important for college students to begin investing. You gain more courage, confidence, you gain more knowledge of the stock market and just general investing if you start earlier. Even if it's $10 a year, you can have that experience and you can start investing before you graduate. But as I said, investing is a very big thing, so there's a lot to go over. This episode's a little longer, but even then, this is just the basics of investing. If you truly want to start investing, I encourage you to research on your own. But today I have Professor Mars. He's an accounting professor at SMU, and he's going to help me go over some of the basics of investing. Let's start with, can you introduce yourself and what you do here at SMU?
Yeah, my name is Eric Mars, and I teach accounting here. I teach the intro to financial accounting, which is like the basic learning how to read financial statements accounting class to undergrads. And then in the summer, I teach an MBA course, also accounting.
Mm-hmm. So for a very beginner, what is the very first step that they should take?
With investing?
Yes.
I think before I answer that, I think the first thing is to really grasp what investing actually is. Mm-hmm. You know, I know it's a word everybody's familiar with, but understanding kind of what exactly is happening. And if I could break investing down, really what we're doing is parting with today dollars with the expectation that we're going to receive more dollars in the future. Mm-hmm. So at its essence, investing is trading today dollars for tomorrow dollars. And when you're buying investments, what that really means is you're buying different assets. Assets are things that we can own that are valuable, have future economic value to us. Well, so if I want to invest, what I'm really saying is I want to use my today dollars, purchase some asset that's going to then produce more dollars in the future, and I can grow my money that way. And it's more fun to make money than working, right? Now, within that, there are different types of assets that I could buy to accomplish my goal of parting with today dollars to get future dollars. So the obvious one is to buy stock in companies. And what that means is you're buying an ownership position in a company. So I get on my phone and buy some Apple stock. What that means is now I'm an owner of Apple. I have a share of the ownership. That's why we call them shares of stock. And what that also means is if I'm an owner of Apple, when Apple's making money, some of that belongs to me because I'm one of the owners. Now it'll be a really super small percentage, right? But I'll get my super small percentage of their earnings. That's the whole reason you would buy stock, or AKA ownership, in a company. All right. And so stock's sort of the obvious example of how I can part with my today dollars to purchase some asset that produces more dollars in the future. There's other assets I could do that with, though. I could buy a property, for example, you know, real estate, buy a house. And so there goes my today dollars. And then I get a tenant in there renting it, paying me rent every month. That's dollars coming back in the future. And then I could sell the house later. All right. Or I could lend money. That's another way of making an investment. And the way you do that practically in real life is to purchase bonds. You might have heard of a treasury bond. Mm-hmm. What that is a loan to the United States. So I buy this bond. That's money going from me to the United States. What's really happening in effect is I just lent the United States some money. And then they're going to pay me back with interest. And so I've parted with my today dollars and got some future dollars. So that's really the essence of what investing is. Sacrificing today dollars for future dollars. And there's different assets or classes of assets that will accomplish my goal. Okay. So one other point I just want to make real quick is when I make money investing, I know the other way of making money is with my labor time, right? And so let's just say I'll pick a non-offensive number. Let's say SMU pays me $1,000 a month to teach here. Well, then I go teach my class 3 days a week. I get my $1,000 at the end of the month. It's really easy for me to see why did I get $1,000? I was here 3 days a week doing my class, grading papers, all that. Okay. If I'm investing my dollars and making money that way, what am I being paid for exactly? You know, I buy a stock at 100, I sell it for 120. Why did I make $20? What was that for exactly? And the answer is I'm being compensated for taking risk. All right. And so when we're talking about investments, risk and this concept of risk has to be forefront, because that's ultimately what we're being compensated for. So if you want to make more returns, you can seek out assets or investments that are riskier. Mm-hmm. All right. If you want to take less risk, well, you're going to get less returns on those. All right. And so as we start to have this conversation about investing and what you should be looking for, what you should be doing, I think it's important to just have in the back of our mind that what I'm being compensated for when I invest and grow my dollars is for taking risk. So mm-hmm. I said earlier, investing is parting with my today dollars with the expectation of more future dollars. It's not a guarantee, right? It's more than a hope. I wouldn't say I'm hoping for more. I'm expecting more, but it's possible that I could part with my dollars, buy a stock at 100 and sell it for 80 later and I lose, right? And the risk of that happening is what I need to be compensated for. Mm-hmm. And so back to your question then. What was the first question? How should we start?
Yeah, what's the first step someone should take?
Well, your first step is ultimately going to depend on what types of assets you wanted to invest in. All right, so I guess deciding that is the starting point. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, like, if you've got some money laying around and you're like, I want to invest this, the first thing I got to do that's going to determine my next steps is decide how do I want to invest it. Because if I want to invest in stocks, I'm going to need some brokerage account. A brokerage account is basically an intermediary where I can say, I want to purchase Apple, and that broker, it's now just an app or a computer that does it, but that broker will then go out and purchase it on my behalf mm-hmm. on one of the exchanges. So if I decided I wanted to invest in stock, the first thing I need to do is get a brokerage account. And you can get these, TD Ameritrade or Charles Schwab, Robinhood is a popular one. It's just an app that basically acts as an intermediary and lets you buy stocks or sell stocks. It'll right. complete the orders for you. But I said, really, I got to decide what I want to invest in first, because if I want to invest in property, I don't need a brokerage account for that. I just need to go find a piece of property. Mm-hmm. So really, I would start with, what do I want to invest in? That's going to then drive what steps I need to take. And ultimately, how I would make that decision about what I want to invest in is going to depend on my risk tolerance and my risk appetite. Mm-hmm. All right. How much risk I'm seeking, like I want, is my risk appetite. My risk tolerance is how much I can actually bear. And sometimes those things can get a little out of whack, you know, where people want to take more risk than they really can tolerate. Mm-hmm. Or what you'll see with, like, older folks is, like, they can tolerate more risk than they really have an appetite for. So there's that. But once you sort of decide, like, how much risk you want to take, you're going to look at your different asset classes and find something that's appropriate for you. And that's why I mentioned that there are different asset classes before. There's something for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, and my grandmother, who's 84, well, she's going to be looking for less risky assets. So bonds, which is a loan, or maybe real estate, something like that, that's going to be more stable, consistent cash flows. She's not going to be investing in cryptocurrencies or cannabis businesses or right. something like that, mm-hmm. right? So first sort of deciding where's your lane, and then once you know your lane, you know, and let's just take stocks because that's the obvious one, or what most students are going to be into. You right. know, stocks are a little riskier than bonds. They're riskier than real estate. Young people are seeking more risk, which is appropriate because they've got more time. If something goes south, they can recover, mm-hmm. you know, whereas my grandmother doesn't want to be rolling the dice at this age and, you know, lose everything. So if you want to get into stocks, like I said, you just need to find some brokerage account, Schwab, Robinhood, or something, so that you can then conduct these transactions, and you can do it from your phone.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about some of the kind of basic investment accounts, such as, like, a retirement account or an education investment account? Can you explain some of those basic ones that most people would, you know, invest in?
So the most common investment account that people are going to see is going to be through their work or their employer. That'll be a 401k or an IRA. And these are a specific retirement account that carry certain tax advantages. All right. And so, and they also generally will have the advantage of your employer matching some of your contributions. Mm-hmm. So this is something that would be done through your employer. It's a benefit that you must be offered by them. But basically, a 401k or an IRA are effectively the same thing. They are just an account where you can put some of your wages into every month. It just gets pulled from your check. And your employer generally will match some amount of that. So you're kind of getting free money there. Wouldn't call it free money, but, you know, they're matching you.
Right. It's like benefits, kind of.
Right. So it's not really free because you are working there. Mm-hmm. It's just part of your compensation, mm-hmm. but... you know, to the extent that your employer is matching your contributions, you should be taking advantage of that, because, you know, if they'll match all of my contributions up to 5% of my salary, then I just can double my amount right there, right? And then those accounts also have some tax advantages. You'll hear people talk about, like, a traditional 401k versus a Roth, all right? And so there's really no meaningful difference between an IRA and a 401k account. There is a difference between traditional and Roth, and it has to do with when you're being taxed. Mm-hmm. But I, without getting too deep into the weeds, I think really the key advice I would give is take advantage of that stuff. You know, now there are some limitations because you do get tax breaks on those accounts. But the catch is you have to leave it in there until you're a certain age. You can't just willy-nilly pull from your 401k account. You mm-hmm. pay big penalties for that. And so that's the trade-off. It's like the government will give you a tax break on that, which you should take advantage of. But they're like, but you got to leave it in there for a long time. Like, all right. And so those are going to be through your employer. That'll be outlined in your benefits package whenever you get hired anywhere. And effectively what's happening is you're just contributing money from your paycheck. Your employer is going to match it. And that's going to some asset manager, you know, some bank or, you know, some asset management boutique firm or whatever. That's then going to manage that account on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Now, as, you know, if I have a 401k account, I will get to give some direction there. But usually it's like they let me pick, you know, one of like five portfolios. In other words, I'm not generally going to get to be trading on the money that goes in there. Like somebody else is going to manage that on my behalf. I'll pick sort of a generic portfolio. Like they have portfolios that are more suited to younger people, to middle-aged people, to older people, you mm-hmm. know, but that's sort of it generally.
Can you like change your portfolio like, at any time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course they're changing the portfolio often. Okay. You know, whoever's actually managing those dollars. Because mm-hmm. I'm saying me and my employer are going to be just putting money into this account. That account will then be managed by, you know, some asset managing firm right. that just does that.
That's their job to figure it out.
That's their job. And so they're going to be changing stuff all the time, rebalancing the portfolio or mm-hmm. getting into other things or whatever they're doing. My input on that is like if I want to just completely change the direction, like, hey, put me in something way safer or put me in something more aggressive. You know, and then within that, they're going to go do their thing.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of talked about it before with like risk management. But how would you tell someone, like, how should they decide how much money they should put into their investments?
That's a good one. And that's going to be unique to each person. You know, I think if we come back to what investing is, it's parting with my today dollars for future dollars. So it's really like how much you can afford to sacrifice today, mm-hmm. you know, either afford based on needs or afford based on wants. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like maybe I could afford to be investing more money, but I kind of don't want to because I like to go out and eat and stuff like that, right? So I heard one of your other podcasts about budgeting. I thought was really good. And the gentleman that you had on was kind of talking about different ways of budgeting, like 50-30-20,
that's
that thing, and then you give like a 70-20-10, mm-hmm. you know, just sort of depending. I would probably defer to that guy, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of how much you should be investing, but ultimately, my advice, I guess, would be as much as you can stand.
Yeah.
You know, either affording to do or as much as you can stand parting with, not going to nice dinners all the time, mm-hmm. you know. And ultimately, we've all got to... Because the essence of investing is just sacrificing today dollars for tomorrow dollars. So to what extent am I willing to sacrifice my comfort or lifestyle today mm-hmm. for a better one tomorrow?
Gotcha. Yeah. And so you kind of talked about this before as well with the portfolio, but can you kind of dive into that more? What does that mean to diversify or to build your portfolio?
So to diversify means to basically just spread your money out across different investments. And ultimately it comes down to not putting all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to invest all my money into Apple, even if I'm really confident in Apple, because weird stuff can happen, right? There could be some black swan event where Apple's been doing something sketchy and some fraud or something that just pulls the rug out from under. I don't want to lose my whole portfolio that way. Mm-hmm. And so by spreading my assets out or spreading my money out into different assets, basically I'm lowering the risk that any one single event can crush my portfolio. And so when I'm trying to assemble a portfolio, I do want to be diversifying both across asset classes and stocks, you know, and what I mean by that is people will get a stock portfolio and invest in a fund that holds 500 different stocks. All right, well, that's very diverse stock portfolio if you're holding 500 different stocks, right? Mm-hmm. But if all your money was in that stock portfolio, even if it's spread out over 500 stocks, I would say you're not really that diversified because you're all in stocks. You're all right. in equity. And so if we had just a market collapse, which can happen, everybody's getting all your companies are going to go down. Mm-hmm. And so truly diversified portfolio would have some stocks. It'll have some bonds. It'll have some real estate. It'll have, you know, whatever else, and really spreading it across asset classes. And then within my equity portfolio, I want to be diversifying there as well, just layers of diversification, basically. And ultimately, the reason diversification matters is the obvious reason is if one thing goes bad, it doesn't ruin my whole show. Mm-hmm. But also, without getting too far into the weeds, but you can actually, by diversifying your money across assets that are low correlated or negatively correlated, you can keep your returns high while bringing risk down. Mm. And that dog hunts because, you know, our whole goal is I'm getting compensated. My returns are for risk, right? So if I can get the same returns but lower the risk, then I'm winning, right?
Yeah.
And there's a way to do that by diversifying with assets that are not strongly correlated or are negatively correlated. They basically will offset each other and lower your risk or volatility without necessarily compromising your returns. And so diversification is a huge, huge thing for most investors and should be really at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And so when someone like has that portfolio, how often would you say that they need to like, you know, check back on it and rebalance their portfolio? Like how many times a year do you need to check back in on your investments?
You know, I think it depends on the asset,
mm-hmm.
you know, or the class of asset. My stocks are going to move a lot more than my real estate is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, just because real estate, it's not as volatile. It doesn't change every day like stocks do. So I could get away with, you know, I've got some property. I'm like, oh, I'm holding that for a while, you know, whatever. Whereas my stocks might require a little more attention.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, though, and it's hard for me to give you like every month or every week or every quarter.
Right.
It really just depends, and it depends on how active you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an asset management fund that's got they're managing pensions or people's 401ks, stuff like that. They're looking at that stuff all the time. Now, they're probably rebalancing every month or every quarter or whatever's reasonable because it does cost money mm-hmm. to rebalance because there's mm-hmm. always transaction costs.
Gotcha.
Right. Mm-hmm. But for most investors, you don't, I would actually encourage them to address their portfolio less.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And ultimately where I'm going with this is get away from day trading.
Okay.
You know, you should not be buying and selling stocks every single day for mm-hmm. a few reasons I can get into. But, you know, for most people, you're best off to get into a good, stable investment and leave your money there and don't mess with it. And ultimately, the reason behind that is because it's compounding. You know, and that's the beauty of investing and why just another reason why investing money to make money is cooler than using your labor to make money is because my labor is linear. You know, if I want to make more, I got to teach more classes or work more hours. Right. My investing money will grow exponentially because, you know, I invest 100, it makes 10%. So at the end of the year, I got 110. Well, in that second year, I'm going to be making on 110. So that new 10 bucks I made mm-hmm. is also now making money for me. And that's compounding and how you can start getting exponential returns. Well, the first rule of compounding is when you've got it, don't interrupt it.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of people get excited and they want to day trade and be buying and selling stocks all the time. There's several reasons why that's going to backfire for most people. But the most important is don't disrupt the compounding. Don't sell your stock if it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
If I can just comment on day trading, because there will be a lot of students that want to do that
or watching
Reddit and stuff like that. Don't day trade. One of the reasons just like quantitatively is something called tax drag.
Mm-hmm.
And y'all can Google tax drag. But basically the idea is if I'm day trading, every time I sell a stock, that's a taxable event.
Mm-hmm.
And if I've held the stock for less than a year, then I have to pay ordinary tax rates on it. All right. Mm-hmm. If I hold stock for longer than a year, I get to pay capital gains tax, which is much lower tax rate.
Yeah.
All right. So if I'm selling stuff that I haven't been holding for a year, I have to pay a higher tax rate on it for one. But the thing I want to talk about tax drag is, let's say I make $100 on something I just bought last week. I'm day trading here. All right. Well, then I have to pay ordinary income tax on that gain of $100. All right. So let's say my tax rate's 30%. Just making up a number. It's not offensive again. All right. So of that $100 I gained, I got to give 30 to the government. Now I got $70. So now moving forward, I'm making money on 70.
Mm.
All right. Whereas if I had just left it in there, my $100 is still compounding. So every time you sell a stock, you trigger a taxable event and you just knock some of it off the top and give it to Uncle Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd be better off leaving in there, not incurring a taxable event, letting those dollars values continue to compound and then pay tax on it at the end.
Right.
And so when you're day trading, in addition to just people being bad at picking stocks, and that's a terrible strategy for other reasons we get mm-hmm. into, that you are interrupting your compounding, violating rule number one. All right, and then also you're triggering tax events that are going to drag your amount down, and over the course of 40 years, this will end up being a huge difference in the mm-hmm. outcome of your portfolio, like 3x or something like that.
Yeah. So basically, if your stock is doing good, just keep it.
Let it ride.
Got it. All right. So now what would you say for just a normal college student, you know, someone who's sophomore or junior, what sort of investments should they look at?
I think for most people, mm-hmm. you know, including myself, is get an index fund, like a diversified portfolio, like the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so what that means, you can buy, and they're called ETFs, exchange traded funds. And what that means is, like, I can invest. Let's step back a little bit. Like, you can find investment funds to invest in. Like, let's just say I am really good at picking stocks and I'm great at managing money, and you're watching me like, dang, Eric, he's making like 40% a year on his portfolio. I wish he would invest my money for me so I could start an investment fund. And I'm like, Elizabeth, you want to give me your money too? And I'll just put you into my strategy, and now you get to make what I'm making. And mm-hmm. I'm going to take some fees off that, right? So in the old days, you know, when you wanted to invest, if I'm not an expert, I'm going to give it to an asset manager, and just what I'm just talking about, somebody that's got an investment fund, I'm going to give them my money. They're going to put me into their strategy, and I just get to ride their coattails basically and pay mm-hmm. them a fee for it. Well, now, or alternatively, I could go put that portfolio together myself. The issue with that, of just trying to assemble a diversified portfolio myself, is I do have to pay transaction costs. And I know there's some apps now that are kind of changing that a little bit, but traditionally it would cost me $7 a trade. So if I put in buy Apple, $7, mm-hmm. sell Apple, $7. Right. So if I'm trying to assemble a diverse portfolio, which the S&P 500 is a 500 stock portfolio. All right. Well, then I have to pay transaction fees, $7 for all 500 of those stocks I buy. It's going to get expensive just in transaction costs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what exists are these things called ETFs, or exchange traded funds. And it's basically an investment fund that I can just buy on an exchange. So instead of me buying 500 stocks, this fund or this ETF has the 500 stocks in it already, and I can just buy a share of that fund. And that's what an ETF is like a fund that you can just buy a piece of, and you can just buy it on an exchange. And for most people, that's the way to do it. Just get you an ETF of the S&P 500. It's going to save you the transactions cost, because you don't have to go buy all 500 stocks. They're already buying it. You're just buying a share of that fund, right? And what the S&P 500 is S&P stands for Standard & Poor's. It's just a company.
Mm-hmm.
And they pick the 500, like, largest big cap stocks, like the 500 biggest of the big companies.
Mm-hmm.
And those 500 companies make up like 80% of the whole stock market anyways. And the idea there is that you're kind of proxying the whole market, not all the way, of course, because it's only 500 companies, 80% of the market, but it's pretty close representation of kind of everything.
Right.
And so within that, you just automatically have a diversified stock portfolio. You're holding 500 different stocks. And so at any given time, you are going to be benefiting from that diversification, because you're going to have tech stocks in there, industrial stocks, transportation, airlines, whatever the case is. Right. And back to my comment about diversification, if there's a war in Ukraine and fuel prices spike, my FedEx stock is going to not do well, because they mm-hmm. use a lot of fuel,
right?
Right. But my ExxonMobil stock, the oil and gas company, is going to do well. And that's just kind of showing you how diversification can work also.
Yeah.
But for most people, just getting into the S&P 500 and letting it go, you're going to average about 12% a year. You know, over the last 100 years, that's about the average.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you have some bad years, you have some great years, but averages out to about 12%. That's the ticket for most people. And this is a crazy stat I'm about to fire off at you, but it's like 80% of asset managers can't beat the S&P 500 over a 10-year horizon.
Hmm.
So you've got a lot of people out there picking stocks. And this is why I say, even me, like, I'm not trying to be out there picking stocks, because even of professional portfolio managers, 80% of them over a 10-year horizon can't outperform the S&P.
Mm-hmm.
They might outperform S&P in any given year, but they can't do it consistently for a long time. About 20% of them can. All right. And so who's to say I'm better than 80% of asset managers? And most people are not in a position to make that claim. I'm not even going to make that claim, and I do this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so I think for most people, just getting into an exchange-traded fund like the S&P 500, or it doesn't have to be the S&P 500. You can do – they make exchange-traded funds for all types of different stuff, you know, and tech companies or industrial companies. You can find a fund that you can buy on an exchange for anything you want. And that's, for most people, going to be the best bet, because you're probably not going to outperform trying to pick and choose yourself. And the reasons why people don't outperform is because of those reasons I was saying, like tax drag and bad selection. There's a lot of emotional biases that make people pick wrong or hang on to losers too long or get into winners too late. Those sorts of things, even though we all think we're going to outsmart the market, we're probably not. You know, get into an exchange-traded fund. It's a nice, diverse portfolio. Let it compound, leave it alone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's all my questions. So I want to thank you for joining me.
You bet. Thanks for having me. Yeah. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us on today's podcast. As always, SMU Financial Literacy is here to help you. Email us at financialliteracy@smu.edu with any questions and follow our Instagram @SMU Financial Literacy. Pony up. This podcast is a resource for students in regard to personal financial management, including budgeting and saving techniques, incurring and managing debt, and in general dealing with their personal resources. The presenter of this podcast and those leading the interviews are not certified financial planners, licensed as financial advisors, or experts in the field of financial aid. However, guests interviewed may include professors, financial advisors, or others with expertise in the area which are covered by the podcast. Each individual that listens to this podcast should consider that the information presented is not financial or investment advice, is general in nature, and is not specific to the facts of any individual.